I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Storper here today. We also need to thank Stickerd for making his visit possible as well. Michael splits his academic time between a post in the Social and Human Sciences at the University of Marne-la-Vallée, Paris, and a post in Regional and International Development at the School for Public Policy and Social Research at UCLA. So with a foundation, I guess, on both sides of the Atlantic, he's well-placed to give us a perspective on some contrasting experiences of economic development, of not just these situations, but many others as well. Those of you that are familiar with Michael's work may well be aware about how wide-ranging it is. In fact, I think any of you have tried to purchase his book in the bookshop will have had this reinforced to you through the interdisciplinary nature and the vagaries of the Dewey Decimal System, I think. I noticed that the bookshop had copies of his book located in the economic section, in the development section, and also the section that I always think is quaintly called locational studies. It ought to also, I guess, figure in the sociology section as well, although I couldn't find a copy there. These taxonomies, I always think, are quite interesting as a signal, I guess, of success, although maybe not for book buying, but a success of practically demonstrating, I guess, an avowed aim of Michael's, and that is to develop a heterodox account of regional development, one that brings in a whole variety of different perspectives and melds them together in a new way. Of course, empirically, one of Michael's abiding themes has been with the concern with the clustering of industrial activity. This, of course, has been a great theme classically within these issues of social economic development, of the localization of social economic development. It's a great theme both for the classic founders of 20th century economics, Marshall, for example, but also, you know, latterly we've heard over the past 15 years of numerous examples of, you know, the Third Italy, Silicon Valley, to name but two occurrences of this issue of localization of industry, something that has not disappeared and maybe has reappeared or reasserted its significance and importance in recent years. And I think Michael's work over recent years has made a significant contribution to our understanding and analysis of these debates and these phenomena. Michael's latest book, The Regional World, explores the issue of regionalization in more detail. And I think it's an issue that's all the more intriguing, I guess, as the more we hear about globalization in the world. So this tension between globalization and localization that is ever present in this work. Anyway, I've said enough at that point. I'll hand over to Professor Michael Storper to talk on his topic, Citizen Regions, Centers of Economic Reflexivity.
Thank you all for coming. I very much appreciate the invitation to come and present to you. And I suppose the first thing I should do is change the title of my talk. That's kind of a standard thing because I decided that I should talk on something that I'm working on right now. So what I'm going to really talk on is some new work on globalization, localization, and trade. That is, I'm trying to now push forward some of my earlier work into this area of that we're all thinking about, which is globalization. And of course, globalization makes a lot of us very nervous because of the image of rapidly expanding flows of goods and capital across national borders, and which makes it seem as if one day we're going to produce relatively few things for ourselves and hence become more dependent on others who lie outside of the political borders within which we think we can influence economic activity, that is to say, those of the nation state. And there's a widespread impression, I think, among scholars and the public that at least for tradable goods and services, there's no natural ending point to what is known as the specialization effect of globalization, so that one day economies will become more global than they are national, and that we will make fewer things for ourselves and import a lot more of them from others. Now, directly tied to this particular view of the globalization process as one of specialization and interdependence, is a view of the nature of the process. And the most common view today is that globalization consists of trade, of goods and money, that is directly observable in these forms. Now, these ideas about globalization, I want to argue, involve assumptions about two very complex phenomena and how they're linked to each other, these being trade on the one hand and the localization of economic activity on the other. When we look at these two closely and in concert with each other, however, we find a rather complex and ambiguous reality which calls into question a number of widespread assumptions about globalization. And I want to concentrate on three such assumptions here. First, I want to argue that trade, contrary to what many people think, is not a palimpsest of globalization. That is, as all trade economists and economic geographers know, trade is the result of two opposite processes. On the one hand, footlooseness of economic activity, and on the other hand, localization of economic activity, or what I would prefer to call deterritorialization and territorialization. What we often forget, though, is that because of this non-correspondence of locational categories and trade categories, we cannot read back from international economics to what is going on the ground. And even, I will argue, that even the most detailed trade-based analyses cannot do this. Second assumption I want to call into question is that we know that behind the back of both trade and location are forces that are not easily detected through standard trade and locational categories. Yet, most work on trade and location assumes that by looking at trade and looking at location, we know we can detect the relationships between them. And I want to argue that that's not the case. That especially in the area of knowledge flows and what I'll call soft externalities in the economy, that these two forces lie behind the backs of both location and trade and are not easily measurable by either. And the third thing I want to argue is that because of these flows of knowledge and because of the existence of these soft externalities, it may not be the case that globalization inexorably leads to trade which reflects greater and greater specialization and the reduction of local economic diversity. That in fact, this is not a sustainable conclusion at this time. Obviously, globalization is lots of different things. It's a complex economic, social, cultural, political process. And it's impossible to do justice to it in, you know, one small talk. And so I just want to lay my cards on the table and say I'm going to really talk about this rather narrow part of the globalization process, knowing that it's narrow, which is the economic part, and at that a rather small dimension of the economic part, which is localization and trade. So I'm going to put aside major aspects even of the economics of globalization, for example, finance. Now, let's start with this issue of location. Location is the motor of trade. I mean, I learned that when I was in school, at least. Trade and location have always been considered to be mirror images of each other by specialists. But this is actually often forgotten today, since trade statistics are readily available, and it's a lot easier to track the evolution of trade in goods and to assume that the mirror image is accurate than to consider location directly. Location's a lot harder to measure. For a long time, trade theory, of course, has simply upgraded Ricardo, using a standard HOS model to assume that the factor content of trade would reflect the underlying geographical distribution of factors of production. And I'm going to try not to get too technical here, and I hope it won't leave anyone behind, but I think most things will become clear if some of that terminology is not familiar to everybody here. Now, it seems to me that there are two strong points to this standard approach. One is that it correctly predicts the rough match between labor-intensive, low-wage activities or low-skill, capital-intensive activities and labor-rich developing areas. and the way this is reflected in the factor composition of trade between poorer and richer nations. And the dynamic extension of standard trade theory helps us to understand subsequent adjustments of output composition and product prices and wages in the more developed areas in the face of such trade. That is, it helps us to understand what happens when, due to import competition, when through trade, import competition arrives on our shores and it changes a lot of our factor markets. But it seems to me that as an account of the geography of economic development, it falls quite short, especially when it comes to complex and advanced economic areas and activities, that is, what's going on in the developed nations. And empirically, it's of rather little use in understanding globalization and trade among the advanced areas, which is, of course, as we know, the vast, vast majority of trade in this world. Now, there's a relatively simple reason for this, but it leads to a complex task. That is, a relatively simple reason for the failure. Our economies are composed of a fantastically complex array of differently structured activities. And it is the organizational structure of different sectors in the economy which drives them toward different levels and patterns of globalization. To get a good analysis of globalization and trade, we have to get inside these activities. HOS theory fails to do this. By ignoring spatial interdependence and proximity relations within the economy, or even straightforward economies of scale, it can only tell us about the most obvious manifestations of globalization. It can only take the broadest kind of sweep, such as the capital-intensive, labor-intensive, or, you know, high-skilled, low-skilled division. Thus, an empirically very small fraction of globalization processes. The problem, of course, that has always bedeviled geographers and even non-orthodox trade theorists is that an endlessly complex series of monographic or sectorally specific descriptions, however interesting, leave us with no ability to see broader patterns. The same problem, by the way, which affects super complicated modeling exercises. So what I would like to do is try something different here, which is based on what I would call the principle of moderate complexity in theorizing, which is to say something that is hopefully complex enough to give a reasonable picture of reality, but not so complex as to eliminate the possibility of making sensible generalizations. So to do this, I want to make five My five propositions as a sort of a starting point is that to understand location, we have to understand the organization of production, because this organization mediates the relationship between a given kind of activity and factor and product markets. That organization, for my purposes, can be roughly captured as two kinds of transactional structures. One is, and these are really classical ones, one that is between an activity and its product markets, downstream, and then upstream between the different parts of the production system that are tied up in intermediate production tasks. Real standard stuff. Now, this is just an analytical way of capturing the relationship between a given economic activity and its two most important environments. That is, to the market on the one hand, and to necessary partners and suppliers on the other. But I'll argue, and this is going to be one of the main points that I'll try to make later on, is that these transactions on both sides are not just hard exchanges of goods, labor, taking the forms of things like contracts and so on, that is, observable forms, but also soft and untraded interdependencies in the economic system involving knowledge, ideas, customs, rules, and conventions, and lots of other things we'll talk about. Another of my starting points is that technology is a strong structuring force behind both of these transactions and a strong motor of change. And finally, that this geography of soft transactions or interdependencies is coming to be more and more important, and that if we could understand it better, as I hope we will shortly, that we could have a lot better handle on globalization. Okay, so to begin this task of construction based on these starting points, we can start where a lot of economics and location theory has always started, which is with transport costs. Now, I hope you're not going to all yawn and say, oh my God, here he's going to do the Geography 1 course, which I have no intention of doing. The standard and largely correct statement made by trade economists today is that transport costs are falling in real terms, and that this, all other things being equal, promotes globalization, with the underlying notion that activities can locate farther from their markets than before. The result is a world of greater locational concentration and economic specialization. Activities concentrate together and serve much more far-flung markets by using this cheaper transport input. And I'm going to call this part of the model, the quote-unquote model or schema that I'm going to build, TTM, that is, transactions to market. Now, as I noted, the other part of the locational problem is how activities relate to each other in the economy, that is, the intermediate structure of the economy, right? Not the structure to market. And this is an area which has generated a great deal of effort in recent years. In general, it refers to the notion that modern economic activity is carried out through a complex division of labor between firms and industries, which in turn have to relate to each other through transactions. They're coordinated through intermediate transactions. The intra and inter-industry input-output structure of the economy has a geography, right? And this is the area of theorizing about localization economies, which has been upgraded in the last 10 years or so. We now have a rather sophisticated analytical view of the genesis of transactions between firms or between industries through the modern division of labor. All other things equal, what we have basically come to be able to say is that all other things equal, if an industry has a more fragmented or more disintegrated division of labor, there will be more transactions between firms necessary to get a given job done, and this will push in the direction of geographical concentration as a strategy of cost minimization. And here comes the disclaimer, all other things being equal. Now, it's possible, therefore, that these transactions upstream, these intermediate transactions, are so intense and costly that firms attempt to minimize them by concentrating together in geographical space and accepting the higher resulting transport costs to market that they get by concentrating together in geographical space because they can no longer spread out to serve their markets. Generally, this line of analysis, therefore, also points in the direction of locational concentration and specialization, whether of the intra or inter-industry type, and conforms to fairly standard views about globalization. Okay? Now, of course, if an industry has a different kind of organizational form, that is, if it's more vertically integrated, more things being done inside fewer firms or production units for a given task, then there will be fewer external transactions, and in general, research has discovered, those transactions will be more regular, more planned, and therefore they'll have lower per unit costs, per unit transport costs, all of which, in principle, lead to a greater spreading out of the industry. Now, as we're going to see, though, that view, though interesting, turns out to be the tip of the iceberg of inter and intra-industry spatial interdependencies and proximity relations. That is to say, and to try to summarize very briefly a vast frontier area of economic research, we now know that once firms are together in geographical space, they not only benefit from collective pecuniary economies of scale, that is, efficiency effects from being together and making their transactions cheaper, that these effects tend also to be self-reproducing over time. For example, specialized labor markets come into existence in these kinds of situations of geographical concentration of lots of different firms in a division of labor, which can and often do give rise to ongoing invention and innovation from which all the firms in the system benefit. So we're in the presence of processes known as dynamic externalities, not just static or pecuniary externalities, resulting from spillovers of knowledge between firms, resulting from what are now called learning effects and the regeneration of industry and place-specific advantages. The two key aspects of these effects are that they are dynamic and that they are in many ways difficult to get a hold of. That is, they are soft. They are soft interrelations between firms or between industries, ways of doing things and exchanges that may not be measurable as trade in goods and services between firms. They may depend on customs, informal rules, conventional ways of doing things. These soft interdependencies could have the same effects as their hard counterparts. That is, by hard counterparts, I mean division of labor and buying and selling relations in a given geographical space. To the extent that they outweigh transport costs to market in the short and long-term calculations of firms, they could lead to geographies of production that have relatively little to do with the geographies of final markets. Okay. So, and I'll come back to this in more detail very shortly. But let's first return to the effects of that. Let's assume that that exists. The effects of that on location and trade, what would they be? It helps us to understand a problem, actually, which is not new at all. Early in the 1950s, Wassily Leontief did some empirical research on patterns of location and the composition of trade in the developed and in the developed world and in the third world, and he discovered what came to be known as the contrary factor intensities paradox. That is, his discovery that the factor content of exports from many developing countries was actually more capital intensive than that of the developed countries, right? Which is exactly the opposite predicted by standard trade, HOS trade theory, right? And of course, the reason he suggested way back in the early 1950s was because the developed countries were specialized in knowledge, in knowledge and labor-intensive activities, while many developing countries were coming to be specialized in what we would now describe as routinized capital-intensive activities, employing relatively few people and with relatively low skills. Okay? Now, what I'm suggesting is a kind of extension of Leontief's logic, which is to say that if industries with strong locational patterns concentrate in part because of these untraded interdependencies or soft externalities, then it would help us to understand why developed country exports continue to be richer in labor and especially in wage content than those of developing countries, but that this would also extend to relations between regions within the developed countries. Now we have the elements, it seems to me, of a workable shorthand, and I'm going to call these, I'm going to use these to start to sort of build a model.
Productivity effect none of us is getting from computerization. It's a lot longer to do a lot of things on computer than to do by hand. Anyway, so these are the two forces I just described to you, right? On the one hand, I'm going to do on my horizontal axis transactions to market, and on my vertical axis, I'm going to do this other stuff, this upstream intermediate interdependency, which I've called transactions, externalities, knowledge spillovers, and factor specificity, or TEX. So I've got TTMs and TEX, all right? And what I want to do is trace out what happens when you get different combinations of these, when you get, for example, low transactions to market and low TEX versus, say, at the other extreme, high transactions to market and high TEX, okay? And basically, what we're going to see is that, well, we're going to fill in a more complicated model,
But basically, we're going to see the trembling projector. We're going to see that when you get low transactions to market and low interdependency in the production system, you will tend to get more scattered or isolated patterns of location. Whereas when you get high transactions to market and high tech, you get different combinations of clustering forces. But there are many different clustering patterns in the economy with many different effects on trade. That's what we'll see. Okay? So let's begin by introducing some complexity, though, in our two axes of this model. Let's begin with this TTM force. The overall story about declining transport cost barriers, though true for many cases, tends to ignore that downstream transactional costs are not just determined by the means of transacting, that is, transport, but by the complexity of what we ask the transport system to do. So, even if transport costs are falling generally, if, for example, we have more irregular shipments, smaller lots, or other demands which make the task of getting to market more complex, it's very possible that our overall transport costs will rise, even in today's world. So in an economy where some products are becoming more and more tailored to customer demand and increasingly service intensive, market-oriented locations will remain necessary for many goods and services. That's just a reminder. But it's on this vertical axis, this tech side, that outcomes are likely to be especially complex and changeable today. There are two obvious forces in the economy that tend to make upstream transactions costs higher. First, in many industries today, ranging from the frontier high technology sectors to design-intensive consumer goods, to some service-intensive or differentiated high-quality manufactured goods, producers are now obligated to organize themselves for great quantitative output flexibility and more frequent product changeovers. They do this in part through recourse to external suppliers, and this raises the transactional intensity of the production system. This is a story that a lot of you know about because it's been told many times in recent years. Closely related to this, however, is what we might call the changing substantive complexity of these relationships inside the production system. Where they involve exchanges of non-codified or partially codified or context-sensitive information, ideas, or ways of doing things, there are powerful forces which go against the grain of declining transport cost barriers. That's because when there is substantive complexity to the relationships between firms, it raises the costs of those firms relating to each other. Okay. Now, now we know that if upstream transactions costs and complexity are high, that is, if these costs are high, then geographical concentration becomes a very interesting strategy for groups of firms, because it becomes the way that they combine a highly flexible output through the recourse to lots of external suppliers. That way they don't have to do things for themselves, and when they need to do something, they use external suppliers, which enables them to be very flexible in what they do. But they also get to be efficient because they don't have to hoard a lot of inventory labor or have a lot of high fixed costs, but instead can mix and match their supplier structure in order to get done what they need to do. So they get high static efficiencies out of it. Okay? So there's something like the law of large numbers at work in this kind of situation. In effect, what you have is a situation where a production complex with high internal transactions but carried out in the external environment has, as a whole, it has as a whole economies of scale attached to it. Okay, that is, it's something like a mirror image of the big firm, but carried out through a different organizational form. Now, scale economies, as it turns out, have become a very big part of trade theory. In what's called the new trade theory, where, of course, the authors, Paul Krugman and Elhanan Helpman, are the two that we associate with as the origin of the new trade theory. What they've said to us is, in place of the assumptions of constant returns to scale and hence perfect competition in geographical space, where you can divide exactly the amount of production you need and put it in its market area, which gives you a kind of perfectly adjusted a location pattern that adjusts perfectly to demand patterns, they introduce scale economies. And they show that when you get scale, you get locational concentration, and you get, in addition, imperfect competition over space, for those of you who know about trade economics, right? Because what happens is that big firms with economies of scale, what they do is they kind of cast a shadow, a territorial shadow, over markets and keep out competitors who are operating at smaller scales. So what this theory does is it predicts much greater overall economic specialization as market territories for particular goods and services are defined by their scale characteristics. Okay? And we get this world of differentiated territorial shadows or oligopoly effects. So that's the story of globalization and specialization once again. Now, the new trade theory, however, is limited in its consideration of standard scale economies to the plant or firm level. What we're doing here is extending scale to groups of interlinked firms due to these tex factors. And in this way, we could say that Krugman, as well as the updated industrial districts literatures, can come together and suggest a global economy composed of localized industrial complexes. That's a reading that you could get of several literatures. You could bring them together that way. Now, however, this view of the upstream transactional structure of production seems to me, though powerful and representing some very interesting advances over old-fashioned thinking, remains still quite partial. There are these other kinds of linkages between firms than those which are based on traded input-output relations. Now I'm coming back to the point I made briefly earlier. For example, firms in many industries cluster together in geographical space even though they don't have many of these traded input-output relations at the local level. For example, many surveys on the subject, including many surveys, for example, carried out in Silicon Valley, suggest that these firms stay in the same place as other firms in their business in order to make sure, very simply, that they are close to the action, usually which they define as being in a context where they can be sure to get access to the latest ideas on how products or markets are changing. Often these firms cite access to a certain kind of labor, even though it is only in a relatively restricted set of cases that such labor is actively exchanged among firms through hiring and firing in the local labor market. In still other cases, firms suggest that they use proximity to help with the flow of ideas or negotiations, even though, as we know, information is cheap and easy to transport, and even people are cheap to transport given the declining price of air transportation. What are we to make, analytically speaking, of this kind of survey evidence, the stories that firms tell about their own realities? Right? It suggests, at least to me, that there are what I've been calling these soft and indirect or non-traded interdependencies among firms. Essentially, it's the only analytical way I know of how to deal with this, essentially having to do with spillovers or knowledge or ideas which those firms consider necessary to stay on top of the competitive process. These seem to be especially important in industries with non-standardized products or in complex goods or services involving a lot of customized and negotiated content, or products and services where technology, in the sense of hardware product designs, is changing a lot. It stands to reason that these interdependencies are substantively complex, sometimes intangible, sometimes involving the actual explicit transaction of ideas or knowledge, but not always. Some kinds of ideas or knowledge are sufficiently complex or changing that they resist being written down, they resist codification, they resist being expressed in blueprints and guidebooks and such things, which would in turn make them apt to be communicated, that is, if they were codified, in an anonymous or depersonalized way. Many kinds of knowledge and ideas don't seem to be like that. In general, I would like to argue, substantive complexity and low codification mean that there will be a strong relational aspect to the exchange of these ideas. That is, that human relations as vehicles for idea exchange would be the vehicles for idea exchange, not codes, blueprints, guidebooks, and other such anonymous and impersonal means of exchanging information. But these human relations have quantitative and qualitative dimensions. Quantitative, of course, means that it's relatively expensive to transfer people every time we want to transfer an idea, even with declining air transportation prices, because it's a time opportunity cost to sending a person every time you want to transmit an idea. Qualitative means, of course, that in the absence of codification, a variety of communicative structures and interpersonal processes is needed to get the message through, interpreted correctly, and adjusted and readjusted to circumstances through trial and error and reading between the lines. So communication becomes complex and conventional or embedded in webs of relations. And this, by the way, is why most standard theories of the information age are rather inadequate, because they treat information as disembodied bits of knowledge in relationship to hardware, right? But from this, it's a short leap to the notion that the cost and time required to make these kinds of ideas cover vast distances and to reach many users would be very high. So when these conditions hold, there are high costs, there's slowness, and there's difficulty in transmitting economically useful knowledge and ideas. As a result, there's a strongly imperfect market for these ideas and knowledge because of problems of small numbers and a lack of transparency in their transmission. So knowledge and idea spillovers in these cases are likely to be geographically limited, and the places where they are produced are likely to have advantages of possessing economically rare, specific, and difficult to imitate resources known as human relations. Now, Paul Krugman has argued that while these phenomena probably exist, that, as he put it, they leave no paper trail. He means that there's no easy way to measure them directly, and he's right. That is, he concludes that, therefore, we should not really bother with them as a possible source of localization externalities, and hence as a driver of specialization and trade. I would take exception to his conclusion, and suspect that these may be the principal reasons why, in an era of declining transport costs, so many specialized clusters of producers have made or reinforced their appearance on the landscape of contemporary capitalism. It seems to me impossible to account for, the standard success stories as Silicon Valley, or even the City of London, or Hollywood, or a host of other world-important, highly-performing regional economies with any other kind of reasoning. And it seems to me that the persistence of these clusters, in spite of certain forms of internationalization of their knowledge, to which we'll return shortly, is evidence of locational path dependency, and that is to say, the sense that there are self-perpetuating advantages of concentration of the agents caught up in these kinds of human relations. Now, this is an extremely important practical issue, not just an academic one. If specialization due to hard input-output relations or Krugmanian economies of scale or soft interdependencies, which I'm talking about, is the rule, then, for example, Europe, that is the Europe of the 15 countries, may well go the way of the United States, whose regions have a much higher degree of economic specialization than do the countries of the European Union. An understanding of this issue is vital to determining what kind of developmental pathways it is reasonable for regions to strive for, including whole countries, in an increasingly integrated Europe. Specialization, of course, is not just a threat, it's also an opportunity to create vigorous industrial complexes with strong endogenous dynamics due to these externalities and their path-dependent nature. But of course, very different strategies attach to an economy in which you expect specialization to be the natural, to define the possibility and envelope, or an economy in which you expect there to be other kinds of possibilities, right? So that should have an effect on what you would want to do to help the economy to get down the pathway. Now, in this vein, I want to suggest that these predictions of specialization due to untraded knowledge and idea and relational interdependencies are actually likely to be only part of the story. There are new forces and capabilities tugging in the other direction, that of viability for a multiplicity of locations for even certain activities which are rather strongly dependent on these non or partially codified ideas, knowledge, and practices. On the one hand, there's the well-known tendency for information and communication technologies to become more efficient and cheaper. But more important, at least in my view, are institutional developments. For example, when managers go to the same business schools or to schools that use similar ideas, even when they come from different countries, they learn to, in a sense, talk the same language. Now, physicists and mathematicians have done this since Newton and Descartes, of course, and the church did it early on through the generalization of Latin. Now, we're not talking of a literal language here, but of a system of signifiers, which are common ways of constructing understandings so that messages flow more easily. The language of international business, in this case, and the language of capitalism. There are many institutional places where this happens now. Congresses, trade shows, professional training seminars, publications, scientific associations, university, industry relations, the exchange of ideas between business schools on an international scale, and so on. There are, in other words, institutionalized practices of socialization within transnational enterprises and between transnational enterprises and their environments, which are designed to build relationships between persons in geographically separated parts of firms and organizations that permit them subsequently to work with relationally embedded knowledge and ideas. There's also a major division of the economy, much of whose activity is devoted to carrying out idea flow, the KIBS, or knowledge-intensive business services sector, which is highly internationalized, professionally devoted to taking the generally accepted sectoral and technological states of the art and then playing the role of bridge to the local context, generally by using their local branch consulting staffs, who are people educated internationally, but usually from the culture, country, language group, and region at hand. These KIBS, as we all know, are important and growing inputs to many sectors in the economy. So this complex web of new structures and practices, of which I've just scratched the surface here, is what I think sociologists might call a new institutional field, which has been emerging in capitalism in the last couple of decades, or let's say growing in importance. It's made the international sharing of economically useful knowledge and ideas more feasible precisely by specializing in building the relationships that make the global local transfer possible. It seems to me that it constitutes a powerful, though not invincible, force for the transfer of partially codifiable and partially tacit, relationally dependent knowledge. Now, there has been some concern with this process in international economics recently, under the guise of research into international R&D spillovers. It's been found that there are considerable R&D spillovers with major productivity benefits, for example, of American research, that is, the spillovers of benefits from research carried out in America outside of American borders, throughout the post-war period. We know less about the flows in the opposite direction because patent statistics are structured only to give us a picture in one direction. But one would expect them to exist in the other direction as well. The research in economics, however, having measured this effect, doesn't really dig into the how and where of such flows. And it seems to me that we need a good geography of such knowledge and idea flows now. This is it seems to be a very interesting area to work in. Now, as noted, there's a lot of theory that predicts increasing specialization due to these scale economies and softer hard externalities. But what if the institutional field that I'm describing has now made it possible, under certain circumstances, for rather complex ideas and types of knowledge to flow internationally? In this case, companies with access to such knowledge would be able to meet international competitive standards in situ, avoiding the wholesale reshuffling of the industrial map, which we might otherwise expect. Evidence produced by the CEPI, which is the French organization that does research in international economics, suggests that this is what is happening for certain routine durable goods manufacturing industries in Europe, those that we associate with mass production or Fordism. In the European Union, for example, intra-industry competition is accentuating in two ways. On the one hand, for a given rather narrowly defined kind of output, there's a greater variety of producers in a given market, and within a given general kind of good, there's a greater number of European producers than before. On the other hand, for a given general kind of good, there are also increasing quality variations, a kind of new hierarchy of output from lower to higher quality and price. And this is true not only of final goods, but of many intermediate goods as well, where trade in similar outputs has grown faster than trade overall. I take all of this to suggest, that companies are restructuring to serve global markets rather than necessarily shutting down and concentrating their operations spatially. So markets are becoming more globally contestable, that's true, but contestants remain spread in a wide variety of locations. Where these contestants are competing head-to-head for narrowly defined products with many other producers, they must, or it's a deduction anyway, be meeting international productivity, price, and quality norms. Where they are competing by positioning themselves as high-quality producers, they are still subject to internationally defined and increasingly competitive norms about the quality-price ratio. The only way to do this is through a significant uptake of rather complex ideas about what to produce and how to produce it. There is little that could be done in isolation. Now, of course, certain high-quality producers have what we might call local technological knowledge. One thinks of Japanese or German car producers here. But this knowledge must undoubtedly now be combined with a great deal of global state-of-the-art knowledge about products and processes. Now, my hypothesis is therefore that in many routine durable goods sectors, international trade is not leading Europe to American-style patterns of regional specialization. Rather, trade has produced a moderate degree of competitive specialization with changes in local market shares due to the initial invasion of foreign producers following the reduction of trade barriers, right? Foreigners come in and they take trade shares away from local companies. The British, American, and even French car markets are now more diversified than they used to be. So initially, trade appears to generate some specialization effects depending on the initial pattern of winners and losers. This was the case, for example, earlier on when the Japanese car makers arrived in America in the 1970s and early 1980s. But subsequently, what happens? Local producers react to this new contestability of markets, and they react using the knowledge which comes in part from trade. That is, the products and efficiency levels of their new competitors, which are in a sense, which travel with the product, the products are the vehicles of it in cars, literally, the products and efficiency levels of their new competitors signal to them what they must do and pull them into the new institutional field, which makes it possible. Trade, in other words, is in a second instance a vehicle of knowledge diffusion. And this diffusion may be a force which ultimately stabilizes the market shares of local firms. At the same time, of course, these local companies will tend to invade their competitors' territories, resulting in a new international structure of market shares, but with relatively moderate change in underlying aggregate locational patterns and market shares. That is, the geographical structure of the markets will be quite different, but not the overall shares. It's just that, of course, now there's a lot more cross-border market serving to sustain this locational pattern than there was previously. In other words, a soft form of globalization, knowledge and idea exchange, sustains a much higher level of trade, but a relatively stable international output and locational map. So two flows increase dramatically, trade in goods and exchange of ideas, without being propelled by a dramatic increase in locational and output specialization, though output specialization within a given within some industries may increase. So let me suggest that if this kind of analysis is correct, that the implications, for, at least for European regional development, would be very considerable in the way I suggested earlier. Now, I guess I'm running out of time, huh? Okay, so I'm going to conclude by pulling the model together. What I want to suggest is that this kind of reasoning gives us something like a model of very different kinds of cases of very different kinds of locational patterns, and helps us to see why the landscape of contemporary capitalism is so complex, and why underlying trade patterns there are so many different things going on. I should say, by the way, that the inspiration for this figure was developed in close collaboration with a colleague, Alan Scott at UCLA, and I really can't take credit for the conceptual schema, though I pushed it in ways I don't think he would have anticipated. Now, so what I've done here is suggested essentially low, medium, and high level of interdependencies inside the production system, and low, medium, and high levels of costs or difficulty of getting to the market, and suggesting that this yields a bunch of different kinds of cases. Take the upper left case, where both TTMs and techs are low. Firms have little reason to localize in the presence of other producers, nor strong reasons to locate near markets. One could expect a kind of random scattered pattern of isolated producers, a sort of entropy, unless, you know, there are natural resources or other kind of scarce factors involved. Given the competitive nature of contemporary capitalism, entry into markets should produce relatively low levels of international trade, but we can't say much about this because low TTMs might also favor such trade. If you move to the upper right case, on the other hand, over here, we find high costs of getting to market, but low upstream interdependencies. And this logically will yield the locational pattern known to everyone here who's a geographer, as those similar to those of Kristaller or Losch. That is, market-serving locations where the only driving factor is really the matching of output scale to market scale, and resulting in a kind of standard nested hierarchy of market areas that we all have to learn about in early economic geography courses. Now, only in the most specialized, in the cases of the most specialized kinds of goods, would we expect high levels of international trade to result. And here, the logic of Krugman joins that of Losch, right, where you get high-scale concentrated production or rare low-scale production because of the structures of markets. Now let's move all the way down to the bottom row. All the cases here have high levels of interdependencies in the production systems. That is, the kind of driving force is that these are complex, relationally interdependent production systems upstream, right? What varies is the relationship to the market, right? In the bottom left-hand case, what you get is something like high upstream connections, but low cost and low difficulty of getting to the market. And this generates one of the most typical and complex geographical phenomena today, that of what we might call interconnected clusters. On the one hand, firms cluster around divisions of labor due to these high interdependencies. On the other hand, in any complex and long production chain, it's likely that there will be many such upstream stages, each with its own division of labor, and hence, that it's likely also that each clustered group of intermediate goods producers will serve more than one downstream client, whether in terms of firms or even whole sectors. So, for example, the semiconductor industry might cluster in an area and be linked downstream to clusters in computers, military hardware, aerospace, and so on. And even within semiconductors, several clusters might form due to differentially intense relationships in parts of the production chain. Insofar as the TTMs remain low, these clusters can form their own geographical centers of gravity and ship their intermediate products, which are the final outputs of other clusters, to other clusters. Equally, a large plant cluster might cluster with its suppliers, but in turn, if its products are intermediate goods, then they'd ship them to other clusters. So this is the geography of two kinds of division of labor, two levels of the division of labor, excuse me, locally between firms and interregionally or internationally between clusters. You can see, of course, that has an immediate empirical appeal with respect to the way that many kinds of industrial systems are evolving today. And it's why, of course, industrial geography and an understanding of globalization have become so complex, because we have nested geographies of divisions of labor and knowledge spillovers, plus local path-dependent learning communities, plus long-distance interconnection between these specialized clusters. Right? In any case, what we're likely to get is high and increasing levels of international trade from this sort of locational dynamic. Okay. Now, this pattern, of course, often involves transnational firms as key agents that bring these clusters together. Right? There's been quite a lot of polemic about this in the literature, where frequently it's claimed that clustering and the big enterprise are somehow in opposition to each other, that either you get a small firm clustered economy or you get big transnational firms, as if somehow they had no analytical relationship to each other. This is, of course, analytically not useful at all. The most common practice nowadays is for a big transnational to assemble the products of different clusters, often through buying and selling or alliance with other transnationals, who themselves are the key nodes in other clusters. From the standpoint of regions, of course, the key issue is how strong and sticky the local hard or soft techs interdependencies are. How much do they really serve to deter new competitive entrants coming from other regions? In order to understand this kind of question, we would need both more sophisticated analyses of upstream intermediate divisions of labor and a new geography of ideas and learning processes, which I would call the geography of techs. Now, if we move all the way over to this case here, we have high interdependencies upstream and high costs to market. In this case, we're likely to get a kind of clustered version of Loschian market geography, which is where what is at the center of the market area is not the firm, but a group of interrelated firms, with the cluster scale corresponding to the scale of the market area's demand. This is different from the case we just examined, because these market-serving clusters are oriented to final demand rather than intermediate demand. As in the upper right-hand box, however, international trade will result only when minimal market area for a cluster exceeds the size of national markets. Now, in between these two bottom row cases, is a particularly interesting third case. When the tech forces are very strong, that is when interdependencies in production are very strong, but the costs and difficulty of getting to market are only moderately strong, we enter into a kind of complex area of trade-offs or elasticities between TTM advantages and tech advantages. We would expect clusters of firms to reduce their transactions to markets by having some locational relationship to their markets. But insofar as their markets are frequently other clusters or firms, the locational logic of these clusters is that of co-location with other clusters. That way, the TTMs are managed in many cases, the way that TTMs are managed in many cases is through the appearance of clusters in proximate geographical space. And there are two aspects to this co-location. On the one hand, in an economy where technological change and innovation are motors for both the hard and soft techs, there's always the risk that clusters of firms will find their previous patterns of relationships disrupted through technological change. To minimize the possible effects of this, they have to locate in an area where they can reconstruct some such relationships, find new clients as quickly as and easily as possible. This system of co-location as a kind of way of managing risk in the in the presence of moderate TTMs has been characterized by a colleague of mine in Paris as the main reason for the metropolitanization of specialized economic activity today. He characterizes the metropolitan economy as a massive territorial system for managing and spreading risk. Although we could say that co-location of clusters is not necessarily and always due exclusively to managing change in this negative sense. We observed here in the lower left-hand box that separate upstream clusters relate well to each other across long distances where their costs to market are low. But if these are high, then the knowledge spillovers and positive externalities that might flow from intercluster relations will also require some degree of geographical proximity. And such positive benefits of soft interrelationships as innovation, learning, and the rest would, in these cases, depend on co-location of clusters caught up in longer commodity chains. And it seems to me that then we have a reason for understanding the appearance of geographical superclusters as the co-location of different pieces of the social division of labor. That is, and this is a way of this is a way into understanding the extraordinary growth of complex metropolitan economies today, of these huge metropolitan nodes at the center of the emerging system of production and exchange. Now, we arrive, it seems to me, finally at the most complex, the analytically most complex of cases, those of moderate tax forces and moderate TTM forces. Big margin of maneuver, both that is a kind of indeterminacy, both with respect to upstream co-location and with respect to geographical orientation to market. Complex supply structures are involved, but they can be somewhat distended in geographical space. Market relationships have moderate cost and difficulty. It's here I want to suggest that the development of this new institutional field of knowledge and exchange, of knowledge and idea exchange, to which I alluded a few moments ago, can have its strongest effects. Insofar as the locational pattern of these industries, of certain industries, was established before the lowering of trade barriers, and hence is relatively widely dispersed. This is the European case. Each country developed its own industries in relative geographical isolation from each other. Then the fact of moderate techs and moderate TTMs can lead to internationally competitive restructuring in situ, as I described earlier, with high levels of resulting trade, high levels of international knowledge and idea flows, and maintenance of a relatively dispersed locational structure. And moreover, given that we live in a competitive system where such a structure does not exist, entry will tend to produce it, especially if governments are there to help by easing entry barriers, as was the case with Airbus and many other high technology industries in Europe. Outcomes for trade are analytically very difficult to predict, but because the trade-offs are so many and hence there are so many possible elasticities at work, as well as uncertainty and path dependencies and all these other kinds of things. But at an international level, we could imagine, for example, that inside the United States, this would result in rather strong levels of regional specialization due to the institutional structure of the American economy. But at an international level, insofar as nation states continue to matter and national capitalisms continue to function as real units of economic action, and I think they do in spite of it all, but it's an interesting debate we could have, then internation competition is likely to use the possibility of international knowledge exchange and absorption to produce these kinds of patterns. Globalization in this way may involve a less radical reshuffling of specializations than we have been led to believe by many theories. In this case, in any case, I should say, this field of international knowledge and idea exchange, this kind of institutional field, should, it seems to me, be a major focus of geographical, economic, and sociological research on globalization. So I'll conclude on that and hope that I've at least convinced you that trade and trade theory are not perfect mirrors of location. They are variously complements, outcomes, and causes of location. Only by developing the two fields, each in its depths, and through a semi-disaggregated, analytically coherent set of categories, or what I've called a moderately complex style of theorizing, can we come to a reasoned understanding of their interrelationships so that when we speak of one, we know more accurately what it means or implies for the other. It follows that by developing both, we would have more powerful things to say about the most important question, of course, which is how they will influence people's lives. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, we've got a few minutes for any questions, if anybody has got a particular point, if you'll indicate. There's someone at the back there. I can ask you to speak up a bit.
The question in sort of summary form is, should we not also carry out an analysis of these forces of location and globalization at the metropolitan level as opposed to just the regional level? And this in part because of also political factors. And yes, I think what comes out of my analysis is that is that metropolitan economies, it seems to me, have a distinctive represent a distinctive kind of combination of forces today. Right? I've dealt with them in sort of locational economic terms, and tried to show that metropolitan economies are not just like any old kind of clustered regional economy. They're what I've called super clusters, right? And that there are, and this is a kind of shorthand way into why we see this extraordinary force for metropolitanization in a world with radically declining transport cost barriers. And so, yeah, the answer to your question in that sense is yes.
Question up here, please.
I'm just wondering if we're not obsessed with geographic space and geographic space, because what's the impact of cyberspace on us? And has some systems signified some cyber attacks? What role does this play on your model?
Well, let's assume that there's this this cyber world with its own networks and so on. I'm willing to buy that that it's a level of it's come into existence as a level of reality and as a level and as a kind of a place of interaction. Place is the wrong word. As a something of interaction. But it seems to me that that's where the problems begin. That there are lots of relationships, lots of kinds of knowledge exchange, lots of understandings that don't get produced in cyberspace, that can't be produced in cyberspace. And that cyberspace is sort of like what I would call the magic carpet assumption, right? Let's say we had magic carpets, right, and that distance was simply abolished. The friction of distance was abolished, right? So, we could get up in the morning in California, right? Dip on my magic carpet to Paris to teach a class, zip to the beach in Rio in the afternoon, and, take in some skiing in, Norway the next, at the end of the day, right? But of course, we don't exist in that kind of world, right? And knowledge doesn't even have magic carpets, right?
lots of kinds of knowledge, in fact, increasingly so, are dependent on rather dense and difficult human relations, on understandings, on complex interpretative processes to become economically useful. So cyberspace complements geographical space but doesn't replace it. And I'm willing absolutely to stake my reputation on that statement. I have absolutely no doubt about it. And I think that No, I think you're absolutely correct that that's what I meant about having about working in this field of the geography of knowledge and ideas. That this geography of knowledge and ideas would give us a better understanding of what cyberspace can do, right? I think cyberspace undoubtedly is, cyberspace allows the transfer of certain kinds of knowledge and ideas. The question is understanding which kinds of knowledge and ideas can effectively circulate in cyberspace without geographical friction, and which kinds of knowledge and ideas depend on human flesh and bones, human relations, and proximity, and other kinds of non-cyber signaling and communication. I think that's precisely what we need to do as a research program.
There's a question over here, and I think one down here.
In some of your work, you have given some thought to the implications of these kinds of arguments for diversity. And on the one hand, some of the things you say about the local specificity of knowledge in time is very pessimistic for countries who wish to improve their economic position. But what you seem to say today is that there may be one class of activity, or certain types of activity, hold up more and also seems to say that there is an arena of activity around the international population, which also tends to get proactively involved in the project. I wanted to just say a little bit more about that in terms of the possibility for countries and hoping to become more a part of the international
space. Obviously a very complex area. I mean, I would say very quickly that yes, it's extremely difficult for developing countries to break into this category of countries that have world-serving, high-value-added, high-wage, high-skill kinds of production. It's not the evidence shows that it is not impossible. We know of cases where this has occurred in both low and high-tech industries, but it is very difficult, very delicate, very costly. Okay, so there's no determinism, but there's great difficulty. On the other side, it seems to me that this restructuring through knowledge exchange of many different kinds of industries across geographical spaces is a kind of double-edged sword for developing countries. On the one hand, it has the danger of generalizing what we might call world best practices to a point where they become not dependent on being in highly developed areas. I mean, a few weeks ago I toured through one of the poorer states of Brazil and saw factories that in certain consumer non-durable industries that are, basically it looked like you were in Switzerland. I mean, they had Swiss equipment and Italian equipment and so on. So that's a danger, because what it's doing is cutting the conditions of productivity from the wage structure. And we all know about that in globalization studies. On the other hand, there is a more hopeful side to it, in the sense that it means that developing countries, too, can create certain kinds of industries which are competitive with, as they say, the best of them, right? And it's not just the downstream assembly operations, but that the whole kind of value chain in certain industries can probably be constructed in at least in the in the more developed third world region. But you know, those are just some sort of preliminary observations.
Just got one more question down here, and then one final question over there, please.
I would say that they're all over the place, that actually in virtually in many of the boxes of my model, that each of those cases has there are aspects of each of those cases that can be rather strongly affected by politics. That is, there are the development and management of the resources that lead to success or failure in most of those cases is highly dependent on local institutional context, factor markets, and behind those are, of course, politics, a lot of politics. At the same time, I think we have to be aware that there is, that's the agency part of my argument. The structure part of my argument is that in contemporary capitalism, it is extremely difficult to, in any major, large-scale way, reverse or even shape the flow of technology. Right? The technology is so central to the way modern capitalism works that it is that, and it it's the lingua franca of this particular socioeconomic system. And as such, it is a strong structuring force. It is structuring in a way that leaves lots of margin of maneuver as to exactly how you position yourself with respect to it. There are national systems of innovation. There are regional systems. There are better and worse ways to manage one's relationship to technology. But by and large, this system for production and diffusion of technology is very strongly structuring of the way modern capitalism works, in my view.
One final question there, please. Thank you.
Well, I certainly didn't, I suppose, yeah, one could say that I would get more market-serving economic activity if I raised I would get a greater diversity, all of the things being for more market-serving activity if I raised my trade area, right? But, we all know what the disadvantages of that are, right? There are, for example, you get more geographical diversity, but you get less economic specialization. I'm just giving the standard stuff from trade theory. And, you know, and basically, they're right about that, right? I mean, in the long run, they are correct about that statement. And there are massive efficiency advantages from having an elaborated division of labor in modern capitalism. And if you basically go against that grain through protectionism, you lose some of those advantages. Now, between that analytical, in the long run, kind of statement and what a given region or place should do as part of that process, of course, there's been a lot of ink has flowed and should flow, right? Because getting from here to there can also produce a lot of victims, a lot of, and can destroy a lot of things, right? So it's a very delicate process. But I mean, I do think that policymakers, they need to know what the trade-off is, right? The trade-off between, you know, a greater variety of output, and on the other hand, the efficiency properties that you get from these forms of geographical interdependence, right? That's the classical story. I don't think my story actually goes against that grain in any way. What it does is it nuances the different kinds of cases and the different sort of ways you might insert yourself into that process.
Okay, well, on that point, I'm sure at a point at which will continue to be debated, can we draw close to the proceedings, and can I thank once again everyone for attending this lecture, thanks Dickard for sponsoring it, and finally thank Professor Michael Storper for delivering the lecture. Thank you very much indeed.